Mr. Cheeseman, reel 18.
Questions I have on the tank of 1937 that you were working with for the first time. The domestic side of the inside of the tank, where did you keep your various personal things and your food or what have you?
Yes. Now, I mentioned that there's a huge rear door. That was on the right hand, as you're looking to the back of the tank, it's on the right hand side, because of the left hand side, of course, is the big petrol tanks, but on the outside, that's blank. So there was a luggage rack there for your bedrolls and what have you and so on like that. They're not wanted on voyage stuff, if I can put it like that. But as regards getting thirsty and things like that, well, this is the day before the can be and things like that, but it wasn't so known for the odd bottle of beer to be wrapped up. There was no rags in those days, therefore, oily rags. It was what we call cotton waste from the cotton mills, but it did the self-serve thing. And we wrapped that up so that it didn't get smashed or anything like that. But you're talking about this business. We are in peacetime, and the safety of the soldier, as it is now, is paramount. So we're on Lulworth gunnery ranges and we're doing some firing. What happens when you get a misfire? Well, the procedure was that, you're firing, the gunner pulls the trigger, click, nothing happens. Now, the gun loader, because he'd be told by the tank commander when to reload, he knows something's happened because of the time, but a gun loader can put his hand over and re-cock the gun. But as he does that, it may have been slow charging and comes back. His arm, which is 18 inches in length, will suddenly become about 3 inches in length with a recoil. So no way can he put his arm one way. We have a cocking lanyard wire, stiff wire, and you could do a, he could cock the gun with that. Only at the command of the tank commander. He did nothing until the tank commander said do it. So he would re-cock, fire, nothing happens. Do it again, 3 times. Obviously, we've got to do one. And it's got to be got rid of. Well, but this time, we're on the range. But this time, everyone knows there's something the matter. So the path that the tanks run along on the range, that would be cleared. The tank would be taken to one end of the track, and the driver would be told, it would be driving straight, to get up to top speed as quickly as possible. The side door would be opened, then when he's going as fast as could, the order begin, hand unload the gun. He would open the breech with his right hand, grab a hold of the base with the left hand, then leave go and get a hold of the beach and sling it straight outside and so that if it did go off, let's hope it goes off outside the tank, but the tank's many yards away. That's what we used to have to do. Now, that no doubt would happen in action, but with a little bit more alacrity, as it were. But now, other things, perhaps, shall we get on to the real basics? I've seen a tank going along with a jet of urine coming out of the back. But could I tell you a really funny story? And that, by the way, this gives you an idea of the welding of the NCOs against other ranks. He was a sergeant tank commander, and he had the old boiler suit on, not the the new two-piece, the boiler suit on. And he was dying for a crap. So the situation tactically was that he could hang place for him. So he told his driver to pull over to a coppice. He went over the coppice and stopped the tank. And there was a nice, obliging low branch. So he undid his boiler suit, just down, and then down his trousers and what have you, and pushed his bear bum over and relieved himself. What he didn't realise was that his boiler suit, the back neck, lay on the bottom, and he did it in that. And then, of course, he hadn't realised, and of course, he was not having to get back in the tank because he had to get on there. So, up with his trousers, belt on, and put this up and way into the tank. And before he told the driver, he said, "And you lads, they're off." "No, sir." Then he realised, and everyone, himself included, laughed their heads off over it. But, you know.
So basically, you relieved yourself when and where you could.
Where you could.
In peacetime, which you could do.
Yes.
But presumably, in the war situation, you did it in the tank then, if you had to.
I've never known of any.
I'm thinking that in war with guns fired, that you would tend to be.
Your bowels are very, very obliging.
Are they?
During the war. There's nothing like a dive bombing raid to relieve constipation, for instance. And yet, at the same time, when you know that you can't go, then it's okay. You know, I suppose your your basic feelings of self-preservation just shut you up and it's okay, that's it.
And we did touch upon the peeing part of it, that you did in an empty tin or whatever and threw it out.
Yes.
We've talked about that.
I cannot ever hear anyone talking, actually, about peeing inside a tin or thing like that.
It's probably not one of
the... On the range, for instance, there's certainly plenty of empty shell cases around, and they're quite large to relieve yourself.
And I suppose in an action situation, it isn't one of the things that you give thought to. You know, you're not
thinking about that. Not on that, actually. No, well, put it this way. You're not in a natural environment, and therefore everything is unnatural. So don't think yourself as a natural. Your body is not working naturally.
Can we confine it to tank situation? Could a tank go across any type of ground?
Oh no, it had its limits. It could get bogged down, for instance, and then of course LAD light aid division would have to pull you out. There was, I don't think it's a very high upright wall. You come to an upright wall, you say, or an upright block of concrete. For a medium tank, I think it was only about 2.5 foot to 3 feet. After that, it just couldn't get over. Can I go on to the light tanks again? The Mark 6 was 5 tons. Now, the engine was on the right-hand side of the tank. Three-quarters of the length of the tank. The driver was on the left-hand side. It's rather heavy one side. And yes, they were very unstable. And we had quite a lot. I know personally of 3 cases where a tank turned over. Light tank, I
think. Is it on a slope? Was this?
Going along and... It could do 35 miles an hour, really in the tank. Turn left, and the driver would not realise he pulled like that. Now, if he pulled on the right stick, that's the heavy side, he'd make it. But if he pulled on the left stick, that's the right side, the heavy side would come right over, you know, that sort of thing, or vice versa. Also, until you're talking about this, the light tank steering was very, very nasty. You know when you're driving a car or a lorry on the road, you say hello, and then you see notice, engage your gear going down the hill. In other words, you're using your engine as a brake. If you were in a light tank and you were under those circumstances using your engine as a brake, the tank commander says, right turn, and you pull your right stick, the chances are 50 to 50 that you go left. Reverse steering. You always had to make sure that your engine was driving the tracks and not the other way around. Otherwise, you may get reverse steering, and it happened many, many times. And you could tell a tank driver, by the way, when a light tank driver, by the way, when he got into his car, because we didn't have cars in those days, we come to call it all round up. Force of habit.
So after the manoeuvres of 1937, you went back to the school situation, did you?
1937? No. I'd now become a fully qualified tank pilot, or they call it spare driver. And I suppose the logic behind it was there is one reserve driver operator which we can call upon when mobilisation comes along. Not that it was ever going to come, of course, in 1937, no wars, but that's it. And so I went back to my the section that I was first went to, and that was the transport section, headquartered transport section, and said cheerio to me little Austin 7, and started driving various other vehicles, the 300 weight comma, the 10-ton Crosley, the Morris, the 300 weight Morris commercial, and of course a little bit of occasionally on the motorcycle. It was 1937. I was getting on with my model, Lord, that was more important than all the others. But can I sort of come in here and say that we weren't altogether, I wasn't altogether marking time, as it were. I suppose it was the same with other battalions. Well, certainly, as regards the 5th Battalion, we were subjected to numerous experiments and all sorts of things. For example, they thought they would try out a new type of tank dress, which wasn't so very far removed from the battle dress, actually. But in World Act Grey? no good. Our headdress was altered. Deer stalker hat? No, we went back to the belly. Of course, every soldier knows the eye sheet. And Rommel knew the eye sheet, the mustard gas shield. The 5th Battalion was subjected to that as a test. We were all given these eye shields, which were pretty well the same as the turnout, only they were very tinted, so they were very bright light, and we were ordered to keep them on during our waking hours, i.e. when the volley came on, they went, and they didn't come off until you went to bed. In fact, it did spoil my I tested afterwards, and we realised that the clear ones were the best. So we had a sort of finger in the pie. What else did we? Yes. They were experimenting with tank camouflage. They put two tanks away out on the fields near Lubbershaw, which is not very far away from our base camp. And they started camouflaging it, and it was perfect. You couldn't see those tanks. No, with binoculars, half a mile away. Binoculars, you couldn't see them. But when they moved about a foot, they stood up, they stood up like a soft thumb, another experiment. What else? Oh, yes. One day, we got to know there was, God, what was it? I think it was 6 light tanks without their turrets. That's right. But in place of the turrets, of 3 of them, they had searchlights fitted. And on the other 3, instead of the turrets, we had the big generators for generating electricity from the searchlights. And I've searched high and low, and I've seen about 2 references to this during the following war to come. But I'll not tell you what it is to start with. We had a civilian, we called him a professor, I think he was a professor by the way, and rather German as well with his accent, but nevertheless, his idea was that, very simple, when you drive in the night time, you hit these flaming idiots with a wound at the headlights. Well, let's have 2 searchlights in front of the enemy. Oh, yes, well, it's easy enough. Yes, I'd mind if for a moment these guns and shoot them out. But if you start dimming them and whitening them and move them, then you disoriented, and this actually did work. I was on that experiment.
This was part of the funnies, wasn't it, in later in the war?
That's right, yes. Now, I've found out what I never did know is it was just a couple of years ago when I started researching a little bit on this, that it was the defense light. DL, no, don't let in for it. Defense light, canal defense light. It was used a little bit in Holland, and it was used also to cross the Rhine. Well, I was on.
So these were early days.
On this. I mean, obviously they would have the proper. These were tanks that were worn out in doing that. The other thing as well is that I was also in on invasion from the sea, D-Day, as far back as then. I'm stretching it a bit, you know. But they decided that the light tank at 5 tons was probably the best to try it out. So 2 huge balsa wood floats were made, you know, huge they were. If the volume of the size of the tank when these were all was treble, you know, and you could, 2 men could lift these up, and one was bolted on each side of the tank, and the tank went into the water, and the idea was to keep the top of the track out of the water. The idea being that when you're in the water, the only means for propulsion is the truck underneath pushing you back. And of course, if the top truck was under the water, what you're getting underneath is it's cancelled out of the top. They tried that. So it's a dual drive.
Which came later again, of course.
Yes. Now, I was never with this, but the battalion was full of it. There was a party went down, I think, to Southampton area. For a vessel which could actually beach. It's a ridiculous idea, isn't it? This is before the war, of course. So you see, we were experimented upon to see, and some of them, of course, worked out okay. I mean, there was never a better protection against the sand in the sandstorm, and those musters, as I say, as Rommel certainly followed out.
And for these experiments, were you getting, as you had done with your manoeuvres, people from other units and even other countries to come and see what was happening?
No, these were more secret.
No.
The manoeuvres, that was the only time we had people from other countries. I can understand why, of course. We shouldn't let them. It would have been marvellous, and it would have been okay for fallen, I would say, if the Germans hadn't learned how to blitzkrieg from we ancient Brits.
So you went on to driving various vehicles. You would need refresher course to keep you up in touch with your Morse code and things, didn't you? Because you easily forgot it. And you never forgot it or slowed down with it.
In fact, funnily enough, I have now forgotten most of the alphabet, but up till over 80, I think that's so bad. But up till about 3 or 4 years ago, and I tried it out, I could top out a message at 8 or 9 words a minute. That's about a third of the commercial speed. 28 words a minute, that's cut to the corner. No, it was like riding a bicycle. Incidentally, whilst we were learning Morse code, it was talking about brainwashing. I think Hitler, the SS, should have had that type of torture. If ever we listened to a piece of music, we were putting the music beat into dots and dashes. If ever we heard a horse trotting along it with dot, da, dash, dash, dot, 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 we were trying to read every blessed noise that was going. Talk about brainwashing, but...
So what happened to you, at the end of the driving experiences that you were having now?
Now...
which is when the 1937 we're coming up to, aren't we?
When we came back from 1937, I was what you called employed as against duty. And so I'm driving these, for instance, the comma, I would go out and bring in the post from the near post office. Oh, can I explain a cold winter's morning starting off the old Crossley 10 tonner? It really is. Have you got a couple of those? Anyway, understanding that you're more in your windscreen, so you would put two of everything on, two pairs of pants, long johns, even two overcoats. Your first call would be the cookhouse, get a couple of tea buckets full of hot water, because funnily enough, those days, no antifreeze in any MT vehicle would drain off the night before. Right you are. Now come with me, buckets of water. I'll come down to the vehicle, the side off to get the engine, undo the plugs, go and adjust your multi-plate clutch, because it is running, wore it out, and if you didn't adjust it each morning, you'd be slipping by the tank.
Yes, we've touched on this kind of stuff, yeah.
Anyway, we come, I'll undo the plugs, right? A squirty oil can full of petrol and a squirt in each.
I think we've actually talked about this when we talked about the vehicles earlier on.
Oh, I see.
And so we didn't go through the vehicles.
Anyway,
I think we did about this.
It used to take me the best part of 3/4 of an hour to get started.
Did you have amongst the various vehicles that you were driving at this time, did you have a favourite?
Yes, I think the old 10 ton Crossley was my favourite. As a matter of fact, when I became fitter, that was my job. What I haven't said, and I should make it clear, was that for a good long period of that time, I was also the fitter, the workshop lorry driver, as well as a fitter. And this is just as the war broke out. They were opening up the new tank gunnery ranges at Castle Martin in southwest Wales, Linney Head, where, by the way, just a few years ago, the German tanks. But we opened up that, and I remember I had to take a whole lot of stuff in the big lorry to there. Because we, as I say, we were opened up, everything had to be taken there. And it's the first time I'd sort of been in Wales, with all hills and what have you. And was the first time as well when I was clearly talking about sitting in a block of ice. It's the only time I ever did sit in a block of ice. But something happened on the journey there. This is the one journey. Going down from Birdley Hill in Gloucestershire, down into Gloucester, is a very steep hill, and it's got a zigzag in the middle. In fact, what it has, you turn sharp left to join the Oxford-Gloucester Road. Well, this Crossley had rear wheel brakes only, six wheels on the back, rear wheel brakes only, no brakes on the front. Your foot brake worked the rear pair of the rear wheels, and your hand brake the front pair. So you can imagine, it's hand brake and foot brake all going down. And I put it into a low gear, but it was getting fast. I had over 10 tons. I think close on 17 tons on the brakes, and you can imagine they started, and they burnt out. Oh dear me. I hope there's nothing coming the other way. Today it'll never happen, but when I met this road, because I could never, I was doing at least 25 miles an hour, I could never get round the corner. So I hope there's nothing coming. There wasn't. So I just went straight on the road and into a ploughed field and stopped there. And of course, I was there for about a half an hour until they came along with the necessary brake shoes, and we would fit the new brake shoes, and off we went again. But it was quite exciting there.
When was the next move in your career after 1937 and
yes,
driving vehicles?
Now, you will appreciate the fact that in the 30s, the army still had horses, and the cavalry regiments were quickly becoming mechanized and all that. But you can't use a farrier to put a tank truck on. In other words, you need tradesmen to look after tanks. But they were expanding at an alarming rate, and there was only one apprenticeship school in the army at that time, in Chepstow, South Wales. And it just couldn't keep pace for the army's demand for what they call class one tradesmen. So the army decreed that anyone who is that way inclined and things like that, they'll give them a crash course, 6-9 months or something, at Chepstow, and reclassify them as first class tradesmen. Well, I was the blue eyed boy of the battalion technical officer. Need I say more? And that's how I gained what I joined the army for in the first place, to become a qualified mechanical.
And what date did you go to Chepstow?
It would be early in the crisis year 1938. January, February, something like that. And I came back, yes, 30 years. I came back, that's right, just in time to miss all the whole trenches built around London and things like that. I came back just in time to miss that, but the emergency was over. So I finished my course when Chamberlain was waving his piece of paper. You can put a date to that.
Were you aware that possibly now there was a distinct possibility of a war?
Even then, of course not. Of course not. I was still looking forward to 1941 when I'd done my 6 years with the colours, and now I've got a trade. My goodness, the world was in the oyster. Oh, by the way, in the meantime, the technical officer looked at, he says, you're going to get nowhere with a third class education. Get yourself at least a second class. But there's no such, in the reserve, but no such thing. And he advised me to take a correspondence course. And I can't remember that, it's a well known one. But he said, go the whole hog. So I took a correspondence course in three or four subjects, English being one of them, to London Matriculation Standard, and passed it.